Hello, everyone. Today we're looking at a thinker who has somewhat been forgotten by the mists of time, but at one point he was pretty famous. That is Walter Lippmann. Now, he is in the background of some of my ideas in the book, The Populist Delusion. There's no dedicated chapter on Lippmann, but you'll see that I refer to his books time and again in there, as well as Applied Elite Theory. And again, some of the assumptions and basic ideas of Lippmann inform my own thinking. Maybe one day I'll write a book with a dedicated chapter on Lippmann, same as Gustave Le Bon yesterday, and some of the other people we'll be thinking about this week, all of whom were thinking about mass media, public opinion, the general pub, the fabled general public. This is what concerned Walter Lippmann, most of all. There you can see him. He died in 1974. One of the most famous concepts by Lippmann in his book Public Opinion, which was written in 1922, was that people do not respond to the real world. They respond to the pictures in their heads. That is a mental construction which he called the pseudo environment. This constructed picture of reality is built from limited personal experience. It is built from media reports. It is built from stereotypes. And Lippmann actually was the person who coined the term stereotype and brought it into a kind of public discourse and symbols. It is this internal map, the pseudo environment, that drives most political opinions and actions. So this somewhat troubled Lippmann because people, of course, in a democracy are expected to make informed decisions. They're expected to have informed opinions, and yet most of their opinions are generated by this pseudo environment. In the past, I've said things like Twitter is more real than the real world, or I've talked about hyper reality. Well, in a sense, the pseudo environment is this idea in embryo. Lippmann says that stereotypes are necessary as a kind of heuristic for processing large amounts of information quickly, yet ultimately, stereotypes provide a distorting lens upon the world. He saw fixed mental images as cognitive shortcuts, unavoidable tools for navigating a complex world. And if you remember when I talked about Thomas Sowell, he has a book called Discrimination and Disparities, where he talks about this heuristic, the need for a quick mental stereotype, which is a time-saving device and then sometimes can even be a life-saving device. For example, you're walking down a street and you see a gang of hooded youths walking in the opposite direction. Most people instinctively cross the road rather than, have the risk, let's say, of being stabbed. Now, you could say it is an unfair stereotype of the hooded youth. Okay, like, oh, maybe those hooded youths are a bunch of choir boys. Maybe they are really nice lads underneath it all. You shouldn't judge a book by its cover, yada, yada, yada. Yet, everybody knows why they use these mental shortcuts. And this is what Lippmann was talking about. Once formed, stereotypes resist correction. They act as filters that shape how new information is perceived, systematically simplifying and falsifying reality in the process. So, stereotypes, while they are useful, can also be quite harmful because they end up giving you a very distorted view of reality itself. And to go back to the previous concept, they are part and parcel of the pseudo environment. Now, we have the myth of the omnipotent citizen. Now, one of the things that troubled Lippmann is that in a modern liberal democracy, citizens are, we are all of our processes, all of our internal laws and rules and expectations are written in such a way that it assumes that the public are actually, you know, that there are these citizens who kind of make real informed, you know, that they go to their local town hall meeting, they take an interest in things. But this is a like these rules, Lippmann says, were written at a time when the world was a lot smaller and a lot more local. The world has become too large, too technical, too fast moving for any single individual to master all of the information directly. In fact, nobody can get their head around it all because it's just too big and too complex. The ideal of a citizen capable of forming rational, informed opinion on a full range of public issues is a myth in modern mass societies. Most people lack the time, they lack the information, and the cognitive capacity for such comprehensive competence. This reflects the structure of modern government. And we've touched on this idea already if you've been watching my daily lectures, when I talked about the iron law of oligarchy and Robert Michel's. It is actually an impossibility for most people to get to be abreast of all of the latest issues in any real depth. Now, you could put yourself in the top 1%, let's say, by reading a broadsheet cover to cover every single day, okay? But the number of people who have the time and the willingness, really, to do that, vanishingly small. And that is why, if you remember Michel's, most people have a preference for other people to rule on their behalf, okay, and to actually spend their time doing things they enjoy doing, like, you know, pastimes, watching sport, World Cup, drinking Pepsi, whatever, playing video games, you know, going to the gym, whatever it is, just enjoying life, and then somebody else worry about it. As a result of this, of the pseudo environment, of the persistence of stereotypes, and of the basic fact that most people in most times, in most places, simply don't even care about most issues, Lippmann believed that public opinion does not actually exist. When people talk about the general public, or when, let's say, populist leaders like Donald Trump, for example, talk about the people, American presidents love to talk about the American people. Every American president of my lifetime has talked about the American people, or the British people. Who is this public? Lippmann argued that the public is just a phantom. It is basically a blank canvas for journalists to paint on. The mass of citizens are, most of the time, apathetic, uninformed, basically uninterested in the detail of governance. Now, you could, you know, rather than thinking about your social media feed, okay, or people who will comment on a video like this, don't forget, the people who watch this channel, okay, or the people in you know, who would watch a channel like this, is a vanishingly small, a percentage of a percentage. Rather than thinking about those sorts of peers, right, the fellow commenters and, you know, people up and down your social media feeds, instead, think about going to your local barbershop or your local hairdresser and making chat with the local hairdresser or some of the other people who are waiting to have their hair cut there. Or maybe go to a cafe. Okay, go to a cafe and, you know, start striking up some chats with just average members of the public about any issue at all. And you will find that they are apathetic, uninformed, and basically uninterested. And, you know, you could start even to explain how what the structure of the system looks like, how it actually functions. But most of the time, you even scratch that a little bit, you will find that they're actually resistant. They actually don't want to know. They prefer, you know, they say ignorance is bliss. They prefer not to know. And, you know, many times in my life, I've thought, you know what? Maybe I envy those people. Maybe I wish I didn't know all the things I did, because it would certainly make life an awful lot easier. You know, what's the point of knowing any of this stuff? It's a good question. And Lippmann, but for Lippmann's point, Lippmann's point was even more thoroughgoing than that. It was that when you read about public opinion about this issue or that issue or whatever else, largely what you're reading is an artificial construct that has been penned by a journalist somewhere. And don't forget, Lippmann himself was a journalist, so he had particular insight into this, I guess, narrative myth-making process, that it's the media that is, you know, when the media says the public think this, it is their creation. Political engagement is episodic. It is triggered only by crisis or dramatic controversy. Continuous popular sovereignty is unrealistic as a practical reality. So most of the time, people aren't interested. If there's something that really kind of, you know, is a problem that starts to get too big to ignore, then you start getting people who usually would check out, checking in and starting to engage with and be interested by the political process. And to some extent, populism could be explained by people who were formerly apathetic starting to sit up and take notice and be like, actually, what is it that you guys are doing there in Westminster or in Washington or whatever else? Then we get insiders, experts, and organized interests. So this won't be news to any students of elite theory. And in some ways, Lippmann could be seen as bringing a kind of elite theory to the educated, I hesitate to say mass, because his readership would have been elite, okay, or would have been an educated readership, but certainly widening the number of people in much the same way that only a certain type of person is going to watch a channel like this. Only a certain type of person would have been reading Walter Lippmann in the 1920s. And in some ways, he can be seen bringing some of the elite theory concepts to the public or to a certain type of public. Complex policy is necessarily, note that word necessarily, because it's not optional, has to be done this way, carried out by insiders, by specialists, by organized interests. This is your iron ore of oligarchy again. The average citizen cannot effectively direct decisions on technical or distant matters. Pretending otherwise, Lippmann warned, produces two outcomes, either manipulation or paralysis. So let us say that the system pretends that citizens govern, that we say, actually, all of this elite stuff, let's forget about it. Let's forget about managerialism for a second. Let's just put the people, let's just put the plebs in charge, okay? Well, the fact of the matter is that there, because of the complexity involved, you're not going to get any real governance. You are going to get special interests inserting themselves no matter what. And as a result, you get manipulation. You get organized interests who exploit the policy gap, steering outcomes for private gain. And you can actually see, you know, in the maturation process of so-called populism, what started as organic grassroots people-led movements over time, over the space of a decade, became vehicles for organized special interests. That happened to Donald Trump. It's happened to the Reform Party in the UK, and Nigel Farage. Has happened to pretty much every populist party because of what is happening. Michels would call it the iron law of oligarchy. He would say, well, look, those people, those citizens just haven't got, they don't really understand what's happening. And so manipulation is going to take over and the organized special interests are going to rule the day. Then the second result that can happen is paralysis. Because you've got a bunch of non-experts in key positions who don't actually understand what's going on whatsoever, you get stagnation. Complex decisions stall, complexity without necessary expert guidance and leadership has this result. And you can actually see that happening in modern Britain, for example, and you could argue in across the West and in America as well, as non-technical people are in charge of all of our systems, are in charge of the civil service, are in, you know, our politicians often come from a PPE background. That's philosophy, politics, and economics. You know, that's code for BS. That's code for you don't know actually what you're talking about. You have no technical expertise. And then they end up putting their faith in all sorts of things that they don't understand, or they, you know, kick the can down the road. And then, you know, within our lifetimes, you can see systems that used to work no longer functioning, or, you know, screeching to a halt, or things like the British military, you know, falling into disrepair because the people in charge don't actually understand what's going on. Okay, so these are things that have actually happened as well. The press and its failed responsibility. So Lippmann, being a journalist, was particularly and acutely concerned with the role of the press. The press carries a crucial but frequently unfulfilled duty, according to Lippmann. It is meant to create a coherent picture of underlying reality. And it is meant to report discrete events and sensations with context and proportion. Does the media successfully do this? Is the media capable of giving you reality, okay, or some sense of reality, of reporting events and not sensationalizing? Does the media always provide relevant context? Does the media give proportionate attention to events? And the answer to all of that, Walter Lippmann would say, even in the 1920s, was no, absolutely not. You can bet your bottom dollar the media is doing none of that, because the media is interested in making money, you know, being mature, balanced, giving context, all that stuff. Oh, boring. The sensation is what sells. Fear, greed, disaster, catastrophe. All of these things sell. This stuff, boring. All of the other stuff, amazing. Today, we would call all of that clickbait, of course. We'd call it slop in today's parlance. But the basic principles haven't changed since Lippmann was writing over 100 years ago. In fact, every single one of these trends has just got worse and worse and worse. Now we live in the age of, you know, outrage, social media, clickbait YouTube videos, and you know, the media are failing in basically every single one of its supposed duties to the public by prioritizing drama and novelty and accessibility over accurate context and proportion. Journalism actively contributes to the pseudo environment and fails to correct it. And one of the ways you can tell just how distorting and terrible the media is, really, you can try this yourself. Think of a subject you know a lot about. Okay, it could be a hobby, could be your job, right? Could be your job, could be anything, just something that you know a lot about. And let's say it hits the news for whatever reason. Then see how the media report it. And see what a big gap there is between your expert understanding and what's actually reported in the media. Okay, this was pointed out to me years ago by somebody who was actually a journalist, who was actually, and ever since I saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, it is ridiculous. I mean, it is ridiculous how bad the press is at reporting basically anything. And it could be anything. Okay, you could be into croquet. Right. Let's say it's croquet and then the media do a story on it. You'll find that it leaves out all the most important details. It strips out all the relevant context. You know, it changes the story even because the journalist, he hasn't got a clue about, you know, he is the worst of all generalists, the worst of all BS artists. So anyway, it ends up with this. OK, and I'm not deliberately picking on journalists here. OK, I've known a great many talented and intelligent journalists in my life, but it is what happens basically in the process of trying to translate anything which has any sort of technical complexity whatsoever to the phantom general public. Okay, it does involve a kind of transformation process where the essence of the real story ends up getting lost. Often it ends up getting lost because journalists have pre-made patterns of stories that people recognize. In fact, there's a stereotype of a news story. If you think about television news, often it's like, well, either it's a big disaster, you need to worry about this because it's an urgency, it's danger, right? Or it's a feel-good story. It's a feel-good story. It's a feel. Oh, and finally, look at this guy doing up windmills or something. It's just meant to give you. It's not meant to inform you about windmills. It's meant to give you warm fuzzies at the end of the news report. Or I mean, and there's so many. There's the human interest story and all of these other pre-made scripts. And the pre-made script ensures that no actual detail reaches the public because it's already almost kind of foreclosed by the force field of the format of the story. Okay. And any journalist watching, tell me this is not true. Okay. Maybe you do your best. And I know there are people who work, as science journalists, for example, or as political correspondents, who try their best to get this sort of thing right. But often they still don't. Okay. And you can share your own stories of how the press end up mangling all sorts of things. Before we get to how public opinion is actually formed, I should mention it is summer here. I still have my summer sale going on. I tend to use Steam as my cue. Well, if the Steam sale's on, I should have a sale. And it's hot. That means one thing and one thing only. Promo code Scorcher. 25% off all courses. Buy it now. I'll play the ad and then we'll get back to Lippmann's view of how public opinion is actually formed. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code Scorcher. 25% off all courses. Scorcher. Get it now. Scorcher. 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 Promo code Scorcher. 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 Buy it now. Oh, it's one of my favorites, One of my favorites. It's grown on me over time. Anyway, how is public opinion actually formed? Well, according to Walter Lippmann, symbols, powerful symbols, bypass rational deliberation and trigger immediate emotional and political responses. Okay, and it could be one way or the other. A lot of you will immediately be thinking of the pride flag or that kind of power, that kind of communist fist that they do, resistance, okay? And depending on who you are, that symbol will go underneath your rational mind and it will trigger you one way or the other. Maybe you're against it, maybe you're for it, but your symbols have a power to do this sort of thing. Obviously, flags are a powerful symbol. Buildings can be a powerful symbol as well. It is also formed through dramatic narratives, stories with heroes, villains, simple good versus bad narratives, and crises. And as I said, media loves a crisis. It's always urgent. It's always too late. It's always, urgent, because this is something that triggers an emotional response in people. Good versus evil narratives, heroes and villains, urgency. Always a crisis in the media, okay? In my lifetime, Britain has probably been in a financial crisis, quote unquote, every single year. I mean, it's always a bloody crisis if you read the news. These things shape what the public perceives as important or true. And then, of course, emotional appeals. Feeling and instinct do most of the work in shaping public belief, while careful, rational deliberation plays a smaller, I would say almost non-existent role. And I mean, this is one of the things I've thought about at different times. I've often thought about, why did the Tony Blair years feel like good years to most people? Right? Why was there a feel-good vibe in the country at that time? Was the country actually doing better? Well, I mean, there's all sorts of ways you can look at the data and measure it and look at this metric or that metric. But that was, if you go into it, all of those were kind of myth-making, narrative-setting devices used by the Labour government of the period, okay, of the Tony Blair era. Actually, what happened is that a lot of the British films at the time, which had been in the John Major era, things like Trainspotting and Full Monty, and you know, these were comedies or tragicomedies based in areas that were run down. Britain, you know, people were unemployed. You know, there was a kind of feeling of grit in the air, right? And that was a whole genre of British comedies in that era. Then in the Tony Blair era, suddenly there were quite a lot of Richard Curtis comedies starring Hugh Grant. I'm thinking about things like Love Actually and Notting Hill, and it was this kind of wonderful romanticized London, and oh, aren't we all having a good time? And if you remember, the television changed at that time. We went from whatever the old fashioned things like The Generation Game and Noel Edmonds and, you know, Brucey's Play Your Cards Right and all that sort of stuff, that Britain of my youth, kind of stopped. And in Tony Blair's Britain, all of a sudden it was Pop Idol and X Factor and this reality show and that reality show. And it was all new. Now, all those things feel like old hat now. Big Brother, do you remember that? All of those things feel like old hat now. But in the late 90s, they all felt new. Okay, and these are the sorts of things that people remember. It's a vibe, right? It's a vibe. What's the vibe based on? Was the vibe based on your actual real life, your actual real living conditions, the underlying material base? You know, as Fernand Braudel would call it, was it based on the structures of everyday life? No. They were basically founded on media representations. They were founded on how is the media making us feel at this moment? And if you look into it, you will see that Tony Blair's government gave a lot of grants and a lot of funding to British films during that time and to British arts and media in order to inculcate this kind of feel-good vibe. And he invited rock stars, okay, and artists like Tracy Emin, or rock stars like Oasis, and even David Bowie at one point, down to Downing Street. Come and chill out with the Prime Minister. This is a new Britain now. Cool Britannia. We're open. We're all proud. Jerry Halliwell, Spice Girls. I mean, you name it. That vibe. You know, and all of those festivals and things that took off back again in the late 90s and early 2000s, Glastonbury and so on. They were all part of an attempt, you could say, to make Britain feel good about itself in that moment. In that moment. Did it work? I mean, first of all, was it real? Walter Lippmann would say, well, actually, it was a pseudo-environment. It was a pseudo-environment. It was a hyper-reality created by the media. That's the first thing. So it wasn't real. But did it work? Did it actually make people feel better? Well, yeah, their emotions were played upon, and generally a lot of people were like, yeah, country's going in a good direction. Feel good. This guy makes us feel good about ourselves. We're happy. Now, Lippmann starts to say, like, look, because the public is generally a bunch of uninterested and generally feckless crowd of anonymous people, there is a strong case for intelligence bureaus. This is at the institutional level. He says, without specialized institutions to analyze and translate reality, policy and public debate rest on dangerously distorted pictures of the world. You don't want to let your average reader of slop media be your ultimate decision maker, because the country will go to hell in a handbasket because they're not informed and they're based on lies. So we do need a core of intelligent experts to make these decisions on our behalf, because they know what they're doing and everybody else doesn't. Now, you could say that there's been tremendous backlash against this ideas of Lippmann's now that we've had almost 100 years of it in practice. What was it that Michael Gove said? We've had enough of experts. But actually, we do still need experts. I mean, the fact that we've had enough of them does not actually change the fact that what Lippmann is saying is basically true as a matter of necessity. You can't do away with the experts. And this is something that this is one of the reasons why populism is a kind of it's built on a lie. The idea that you could do away with all of this is always a mystification and an illusion and a delusion. Modern democracy requires specialized intelligence bureaus, expert organizations tasked with producing more accurate accounts of complex realities. These bodies would serve both decision makers and wider public, supplying better maps of the world to replace the pseudo environment's distortions. Now, where this starts to get dark is that Lippmann's vision of these kind of benign intelligence bureaus producing neutral reports on behalf of the public. I mean, it may have started in that way, but certainly that's not what we have now, because they actually feed into and try to manipulate the pseudo environment. They have become part of the process in themselves. You could argue, that they became corrupted by the same forces that corrupted the media have now corrupted those intelligence bureaus. That does not mean that Lippmann's fundamental argument in the first place, that you actually need these for in a mass society, is false. It's obviously not. So they do provide a valuable and a real function. The trouble is, how do we stop them getting corrupted? The gap that cannot be closed by votes alone, the growing distance between the real environment and the pseudo environment, creates a fundamental problem for self-government. More votes and greater transparency are insufficient remedies in and of themselves. Why? Because, like, you can make something as transparent as possible. The public is still the public, right? The public still doesn't really exist and need stuff fed to them all the time just to know anything. So, you know, transparency means nothing. In fact, we've seen in recent years, the public were given huge amounts of transparent information about, you know, there was the Twitter files and the Epstein files and, yeah, so what? I mean, so what? Didn't absolutely nothing resulted as a result of that transparency, because the underlying structural problem that Lippmann is talking about, you know, has still not been addressed. What democratic competence requires, Lippmann argued, is better pictures of reality, more accurate, more contextualized, and more honestly constructed. In his later work, Lippmann grew increasingly pessimistic about mass democracy without strong moral foundations. He argued that without a shared public philosophy grounded in tradition and moral realism, democracy tends towards manipulation. It tends towards moral confusion and the triumph of organized interests over genuine deliberation. Majoritarianism alone, that is, if you just let the will of the mob take over, unrestrained by shared norms, was as dangerous as the pseudo-environment itself. So Lippmann gives us a central warning. Better institutions, better journalism, better maps of reality are all necessary. Without a common moral framework, however, to guide all of their uses, they remain insufficient. And this is ultimately where a lot of these thinkers that we've looked at end up. Carl Schmitt said much the same thing, that, look, everybody needs to be, broadly speaking, on the same page. We need to share a political formula, a moral vision, an ideology, if you want. Democracy requires both epistemic reform and moral foundations to function well. And as I mentioned, Lippmann, in the end, he was like, maybe this whole democracy thing might not work out after all. If he was to come back today and have a look at what has transpired over the past 100 years, I don't think he would be any more optimistic, let's put it that way. And probably he'd come back and say, well, guys, I told you so. I told you so. Anyway, there we go. That's Walter Lippmann. Very interesting thinker. Tomorrow I'll be looking at another interesting thinker, Edward Bernays. Some might say the darker side of this equation. We'll get into that when the time comes. Promo code Scorcher gets you 25% off all courses. Buy it now. Trivium, the bestseller. And I'll see you all next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.